"This isn't one of the Forsaken," Nynaeve began, but the motherly eyes Sedai cut her off firmly. "Don't argue, child, just open yourself. We have expected an attack, if not exactly like this, and planned for it. Quickly, child, there is no time to squander on idle chatter." Snapping her mouth shut, Nynaeve tried to put herself on that brink where you embraced Sidar on the moment of surrender. It was not easy. Twice she felt the power flow not just into her, but through her into Anaya, and twice it snapped back. Anaya's mouth tightened. She stared at Nynaeve as though thinking she did it on purpose. The third time was like being seized by the scruff of the neck. Sidar swept through Nynaeve to Anaya, and when she attempted to pull back, it was her, she realized, not the flow itself. Her flow was held, melting into a larger. A sense of awe came over her. She found herself looking at the faces of the others, wondering if they felt the same. She was a part of something more than herself, greater than herself. Not just the one power. Emotions tumbled in her head. Fear and hope and relief. And yes, awe, more than any other. A sense of calm that had to come from the Aes Sedai, and she could not tell which emotions were hers. It should have been chilling, but she felt closer to these women than she could have to any sister, as if they were all one flesh. A lanky gray named Ashmanela smiled warmly at her, seemingly recognizing her thoughts. Nynaeve's breath caught as it occurred to her that she no longer felt angry. Anger had vanished, swallowed in wonder. Yet somehow, now that control had passed to the Blue Sister, the flow of Sidar continued. Her eyes fell on Nicola and found no sisterly smile, only that considering study. Reflexively, Nynaeve tried to pull back from the link, and nothing happened. Until Anaya broke the circle, she was part of it, and that was that. Elaine joined much more easily, first slipping the silver bracelet into her robe's pocket. Cold sweat broke out on Nynaeve's face. What might have happened had Elaine entered the link already linked to Mogedion by the Eidom? She had no notion, which only made the question worse. Nicola frowned from Nynaeve to Elaine. Surely she could not separate out which emotions were which, not when Nynaeve could not tell her own. The final two were brought into the circle just as easily. Shimoku, a pretty dark-eyed Kandori who had become accepted just before the tower divided, and Kalindin, a Taraboner with her black hair and a multitude of thin braids, who had been accepted for a good 10 years. A woman little more than a novice, and another who struggled for every scrap she learned, but they had no trouble linking. Suddenly Nicola spoke, sounding half asleep. "The lion sword, the dedicated spear, she who sees beyond, three on the boat, and he who is dead yet lives. The great battle done, but the world not done with battle. The land divided by the return, and the guardians balance the servants. The future teeters on the edge of a blade." Anaya stared at her. "What was that, child?" Nicola blinked. "Did I say something, Aes Sedai?" she asked weakly. "I feel peculiar." "Well, if you're going to be sick," Anaya said briskly, "get it over with. Linking takes some women funny the first time. We have no time to coddle your stomach." As if to prove it, she gathered her skirts and started down the street. "Stay close now, all of you, and sing out if you see something that needs dealing with." That was hardly a problem. People milled about in the streets, crying out to know what was happening, or just crying out, and things moved. Doors slammed and windows banged open with no one touching them. Crashes and splinterings came from inside the houses. Pots, tools, stones, anything loose might leap or dart at any moment. A stout cook in her shift snagged a hurtling bucket out of the air with a nearly hysterical laugh. But when a pale, lean fellow in his small clothes tried to knock away a stick of firewood, the result was the crack of his arm breaking. Ropes writhed their way about legs and arms, and even people's clothes began to crawl. They found a hairy man with his shirt wrapped around his head, flailing about so hard he kept at bay those who were trying to peel it away before it smothered him. A woman who had managed to pull on a dress, if not fasten it up, clung to the thatch on the edge of a roof, shrieking at the top of her lungs as the dress tried to haul her across the house, or maybe into the sky. Dealing with these things proved no more problem than finding them. The flows of power Anaya wielded through the link, and those from other circles, would have had no trouble stopping a herd of charging bulls, much less a kettle that took it in its mind to fly. And once a thing was stopped, whether by the power or by hand, it seldom stirred again. There were just so many of them. There was not even time to stop for healing unless a life was in danger. Bruises, bleeding, and broken bones had to wait while another fence board was slapped to the ground, hopefully before it split a head. Another barrel halted in its wild rolling before it broke a leg. A sense of frustration grew in Nynaeve. So many things to quell, all small, but a man with his skull cracked by a frying pan or a woman strangled by her own shift was as dead as someone struck down by the power. It was not just her frustration. She thought it came from every woman in the circle, even the Aes Sedai. But all she could do was march along with the others, watch Anaya weave the combination of their flows to battle a thousand small dangers. Nynaeve lost herself in being a conduit, in being one with a dozen other women. Finally, Anaya halted, frowning. The link dissolving caught Nynaeve by surprise. For a moment she sagged where she stood, staring uncomprehendingly. Moans and weeping had replaced screams and shouts. The palely lit street was still, except for people trying to help the injured. By the moon, less than an hour had passed, but it seemed to Nynaeve like 10. Her back ached where the stool had hit her, her knees wobbled, her eyes felt scrubbed. She yawned so hard she thought her ears would pop. "Not at all what I expected from one of the Forsaken," Anaya muttered only half under her breath. She sounded tired, too, but she launched right into the next thing to be done, catching Nicola by the shoulder. "You can hardly stand. Bed for you. Off you go, child. I want to speak to you first thing in the morning before breakfast. Angla, you stay. You can link again and lend a little strength for the healing. Lanita, bed." "It wasn't the Forsaken," Nynaeve said. Mumbled, really. Like she was tired. "It was a bubble of evil." The three Aes Sedai stared at her. For that matter, so did the rest of the Accepted, except for Elaine, and the novices, too. Even Nicola, who had not yet gone. For once, Nynaeve did not care how much the woman weighed her with her eyes. She was too sleepy to care. "We saw one in Tyr," Elaine said. "In the stone. Only the aftermath, really, but that was closer than either of them had ever hoped to be again. If Samael attacked us, he wouldn't toss sticks about." Ashmanela exchanged unreadable glances with Baratine, a green who managed to make rail thin look gracefully slender and a long nose look elegant. Anaya never flickered an eyelid. "You seem to have plenty of energy left, Elaine. You can help with the healing, too. And you, Nynaeve. You've lost it again, haven't you? Well, you look as if you ought to be carried to bed, but you will have to find your own way. Shimoku, stand up and go to bed, child. Kalindin, you come with me." "Anaya Sedai," Nynaeve said carefully. "Elaine and I found something tonight. If we could speak to you tomorrow, child. To bed with you. Now, before you fall down." Anaya did not even wait to see whether she was obeyed. Drawing Kalindin after her, she strode to a groaning man lying with his head in a woman's lap and bent over him. Ashmanela pulled Elaine another way, and Baratine took Angla a third. Before she vanished into the crowd, Elaine looked over her shoulder at Nynaeve and shook her head slightly. Well, perhaps this was not the best time or place to bring up the bowl and Ebudar. There had been something odd in Anaya's reaction, as though she would be disappointed to learn this truly had not been an attack by the Forsaken. Why? She was too tired to think straight. Anaya might have controlled the flows, but Saidar had passed through Nynaeve for a good hour, enough to weary someone who had had a good night's sleep. Swaying, Nynaeve caught sight of Theodrin. The Damani woman limped along with a pair of white-clad novices at her side, pausing where someone seemed to have an injury her skill at healing could handle. She did not see Nynaeve. "I will go to bed," Nynaeve thought sullenly. "Anaya Sedai told me to." Why had Anaya seemed disappointed? Some thought nuzzled at the corner of her mind, but she was too sleepy to catch it. her steps dragged, nearly stumbling on level ground. She would go to sleep, and Theodrin could make of it what she wanted. Chapter 15. A Pile of Sand. Egwene's eyes opened, stared at nothing. For a moment she lay on her bedding, idly fingering the great serpent ring on its thong around her neck. Wearing it on her hand caused too many odd looks. Easier to fit in as a student of the Wise Ones if no one thought of her as Aes Sedai. Which she was not, of course. She was accepted, yet had pretended to be Aes Sedai so long she sometimes almost forgot that she was not. A bit of early sunlight crept in at the door flap, barely lighting the tent's interior. She might as well not have slept at all, and her temples were throbbing. Since the day Lanfear had nearly killed her and Avienda, the day the Forsaken and Moiraine had killed each other, her head always hurt after a visit to Tel Irunriod, though never enough to be a real bother. Anyway, back home, Nynaeve had taught her something of herbs, and she had managed to find a few of the right sort here in Cairhien. Sleepwell root would make her drowsy, or maybe as weary as she was, it might put her under for hours, but it would clear any vestige of a headache. Climbing to her feet, she straightened her twisted, sweat-soaked shift and padded across the layered carpets to the wash basin, a carved crystal bowl that had probably once held wine punch for some nobleman. In any case, it held plain water as well as the blue-glazed pitcher did, water that hardly felt cool at all when she splashed it on her face. Her gaze met her own eyes in the small gilt-framed mirror propped against the dark tent wall, and her cheeks crimsoned. "Well, what did you think would happen?" she whispered. She would not have thought it possible, but her reflection's face grew redder. It had only been a dream. Not like Tel Irunriod, where what happened to you was real when you woke. But she remembered everything, just as if it had been real. She thought her cheeks might burn right off. Just a dream, and Gawain's dream at that. He had no right to dream about her like that. It was all his doing, she told her reflection angrily. Not mine. I had no choice in it. Her mouth snapped shut ruefully, trying to hold a man at fault for his dreams, and talking to a mirror like a goose head. Pausing at the door flap, she stooped to peer out. Her low tent stood on the edge of the Aiel encampment. The gray walls of Cairhien rose some 2 miles to the west across the bare hills, with nothing between except the charred ground where Forgate had once encircled the city. By the sharp cast to the light, the sun was just peeking over the horizon, yet Aiel already bustled among the tents. No early rising for her this morning. After a whole night out of her body, her cheeks heated again. Light, was she going to go the rest of her life blushing over a dream? She was very much afraid she might. After that, she could sleep until afternoon. The smell of cooking porridge was no competition for heavy eyelids. Wearily, she went back to her blankets and collapsed, rubbing her temples. She was too tired to prepare the sleepwell root, but then she thought she was too tired for it to matter. The dull pain always faded in an hour or so. It would be gone when she woke. Given everything, it was no surprise that Gawain filled her dreams. Sometimes she repeated one of his, though not exactly, of course. In her versions, certain embarrassing events just did not occur, or at least were glossed over. Gawain spent a good deal more time reciting poetry and holding her while they watched sunrises and sunsets. He did not stumble over saying he loved her either, and he looked as handsome as he really was. Others were all her own. Tender kisses that lasted forever. Him kneeling while she cupped his head in her hands. Some made no sense. Twice, right atop one another, she dreamed of taking him by the shoulders and trying to turn him to face the other way against his will. Once he brushed her hands away roughly, the other time she was somehow stronger than he. The two blended together hazily. In another he began swinging a door closed on her, and she knew if that narrowing gap of light vanished she was dead. Dreams tumbled through her head, not all of him, and usually nightmarish. Perrin came and stood before her, a wolf lying at his feet, a hawk and a falcon perched on his shoulders glaring at each other over his head. Seemingly unaware of them, he kept trying to throw away that axe of his, until finally he ran, the axe floating through the air, chasing him. Again, Perrin, he turned away from a tinker and ran, faster and faster, though she called for him to come back. Matt spoke strange words she almost understood, the old tongue, she thought, and two ravens alighted on his shoulders, claws sinking through his coat into the flesh beneath. He seemed no more aware of them than Perrin had been of the hawk and falcon, yet defiance passed across his face, and then grim acceptance. In another, a woman, face shrouded in shadow, beckoned him toward great danger. Egwene did not know what, only that it was monstrous. Several concerned Rand, not all bad, but all odd. Elaine, forcing him to his knees with one hand. Elaine and Min and Avienda, sitting in a silent circle around him, each in turn reaching out to lay a hand on him. Him walking toward a burning mountain, something crunching beneath his boots. She stirred and whimpered. The crunching things were the seals on the Dark One's prison, shattering with his every step. She knew it. She did not need to see them to know. Feeding on fear, her dreams became worse. The two strange women she had been seeing in Tel Iron Riad caught her and dragged her before a table full of hooded women, and when they took off their heads, every one was Leandrin, the black sister who had captured her in Tyr. A hard-faced Shonchan woman handed her a silvery bracelet and necklace, connected by a silvery leash, an eidam. That made her cry out. Shonchan had put an eidam on her once. She would die before letting it happen again. Rand capered through the streets of Kyrian, laughing as he blasted buildings and people with lightning and fire, and other men ran with him, hurling the power. That awful amnesty of his had been announced in Kyrian, but surely no man would choose to channel. The Wise Ones caught her in Tel Iron Riad and sold her like an animal in the lands beyond the Aiel Waste. That was what they did to Kyrian and they found in the Waste. She stood outside herself, watching her face melt, her skull crack open, and dimly seen shapes poke at her with hard sticks. Poke at her. Poke. She bolted up, gasping, and Coenda sat back on her heels beside the bed, head bowed in the cowl of her white woolen robe. "Forgive me, Aes Sedai. I only meant to wake you to break the night's fast." "You didn't have to jab a hole in my ribs," Egwene muttered, and was instantly sorry. Irritation flared in Coenda's deep blue eyes and was snuffed out, hidden behind the Gaishine mask of compliant acceptance. Sworn to obey meekly and touch no weapon for a year and a day, Gaishine accepted whatever happened, whether a rude word, a blow, even a knife in the heart, very likely. Though, to an Aiel, killing a Gaishine was the same as killing a child. There was no excuse. The perpetrator would be struck down by his own brother or sister. Yet it was a mask, Egwene was certain. Gaishine worked at it doggedly, but they were still Aiel, and a people less meek Egwene could not imagine. Even one like Coenda, who refused to put off the white when her year and a day was done. Her refusal was an act of stubborn pride and defiance, as much as any man refusing to retreat from 10 enemies. Such tangles the Aiel's Je'eto got them into. That was one reason Egwene tried to watch how she spoke to Gaishine, especially those like Coenda. They had no way to fight back without violating everything they believed in. On the other hand, Coenda had been a maiden of the spear, and would be again if she could ever be convinced to put off that robe. Forgetting the power, she could probably tie Egwene into a knot while honing a spear at the same time. "I do not want any breakfast," Egwene told her. "Just go away and let me sleep." "No breakfast?" Amice said, necklaces and bracelets of ivory and silver and gold clicking as she ducked into the tent. She wore no rings, Aiel did not, but for the rest she had on enough to do 3 women with some to spare. "I thought your appetite, at least, had recovered fully." Bear and Milane followed her in, each as bedecked with jewelry. The 3 were from different clans, but where most other Wise Ones who had crossed the Dragon Wall stayed close to their septs, their tents were together nearby. They took places on bright tasseled cushions at the foot of her bedding, adjusting the dark shawls Aiel women never seem to be without. Those not far Darais Mai, anyway. Anis was as white-haired as Bear, but where Bear's grandmotherly face bore deep creases, Anis looked oddly young, perhaps because of the contrast between hair and face. She said it had been nearly as pale when she was a child. Usually Bear or Anis took the lead, but today Melaine, sun-haired and green-eyed, spoke first. "If you stop eating, you cannot get well. We had considered letting you come to the next meeting with the other Aes Sedai. They ask every time when you will come, and make Wetlander fools of themselves every time," Anis put in acidly. She was not a sour woman, but the Aes Sedai in Salidar seemed to make her so. Maybe it was just meeting Aes Sedai. By custom, wise ones avoided them, especially wise ones who could channel, like Anis and Melaine. Besides, they were not pleased that the Aes Sedai had replaced Nynaeve and Elaine at the meetings. Neither was Egwene. She suspected the wise ones felt they had impressed those two with the seriousness of Tel Arunriod. By the fragments she heard of the meetings now, the Aes Sedai were not impressed at all. Very little impressed Aes Sedai. "But we may have to think again," Melaine went on calmly. She had been prickly as a thorn bush before her recent marriage, but little seemed to crack her composure now. "You must not return to the dream until your body has its full strength back." "Your eyes are pinched," Bear said, in a concerned, reedy voice that matched her face. In many ways she was the hardest of the three, though. "Did you sleep poorly?" "How could she otherwise?" Anis asked grumpily. "I tried to look in on her dreams 3 times last night and found nothing. No one can sleep well if they do not dream." Egwene's mouth went dry in a heartbeat. Her tongue clove to the roof of her mouth. They would have to check on the one night she was not back in her body in just a few hours. Melaine frowned. Not at Egwene, at Coinda, still kneeling with her head down. "There is a pile of sand near my tent," she said with something near her old sharpness. "You will search it grain by grain until you find one red grain. If it is not the one I seek, you will have to begin again. Go now." Coinda merely bowed until her face touched the colorful carpets, then scampered out. Looking at Egwene, Melaine smiled pleasantly. "You seem surprised. If she will not do what is proper on her own, I will make her decide to do it. Since she claims to serve me yet, she is still my responsibility." Bear's long hair swung as she shook her head. "It will not work." She adjusted her shawl on angular shoulders. Egwene sweated in just her shift, with the sun not really up yet, but the Aiel were used to far hotter. "I have beaten Zurich and Byra until my arm wearied, but however many times I tell them to take off the white, they are back in the robes before sunset." "It is an abomination," Anis muttered. "Since we crossed into the wetlands, a full quarter of those whose time is done have refused to return to their septs. They twist Ji'ito beyond its meaning." That was Rand's doing. He had revealed to all what only clan chiefs and wise ones had known before, that once all Aiel had refused to touch weapons or do violence. Now some believed they all properly should be Gaishine. Others refused to accept Rand as the Karakarn because of it, and still a few each day went to join the Shido in the mountains to the north. Some simply threw down their weapons and vanished. No one knew what came of them. Taken by the bleakness, the Aiel called it. The strangest part of it to Egwene was that none of the Aiel blamed Rand, except the Shido, anyway. The prophecy of Roydian said that the Karakarn would take them back and destroy them. Back to what? None seemed certain. But that he would destroy them somehow, they accepted as calmly as Coinda had begun a task she knew was hopeless. Right that moment, Egwene would not have cared if every Aiel in Cairhien donned a white robe. Let these wise ones even suspect what she had been up to. She would have dug through 100 piles of sand willingly, but she did not think she would be so lucky. Her punishment would be much worse. Once Anis had said if she failed to do exactly as she was told, the world of dreams being too dangerous without that promise, Amis would no longer teach her. No doubt the others would agree. That was the punishment she feared. Better 1,000 piles of sand under a broiling sun. "Do not look so shaken," Bear chuckled. "Amis is not angry at all wetlanders, certainly not at you who have become like a daughter of our tents. It is your sister, Aes Sedai. The one called Carlinia suggested we may be holding you against your will." "Suggested?" Amis's pale eyebrows climbed nearly to her hairline. "The woman said as much." "And learned to guard her tongue better," Bear laughed, rocking on her scarlet cushion. "I will wager she did. When we left them, she was still yelping and trying to get those scarlet puffers out of her dress." "A scarlet puffer," she confided to Egwene, "looks much like a red adder if your eye is dull like a wetlander's. But it is not poisonous. It does wriggle when confined, though." Amis sniffed. "They would have been gone if she thought of them gone. The woman learns nothing. The Aes Sedai we served in the Age of Legends could not have been such fools." But she sounded mollified. Milane was chortling quite openly, and Egwene found herself giggling too. Some Aiel humor was beyond explaining, but not this. She had only met Carlinia 3 times, but the image of that stiff, icily supercilious woman dancing about trying to haul snakes out of her dress, it was all she could do to keep from laughing out loud. "At least your humor is in good fettle," Milane said. "The head pains have not come back?" "My head feels fine," Egwene lied, and Bear nodded. "Good. We were worried when they persisted. So long as you refrain from entering the dream for a while longer, they should stay away. Do not fear you suffer any ill effect from them. The body uses pain to tell us to rest." That nearly made Egwene laugh again, though not in humor. Aiel ignored gaping wounds and broken bones because they could not be bothered right then. "How much longer do I have to stay out?" she asked. She hated lying to them, but she hated doing nothing even worse. The first 10 days after Lanfear hit her with whatever that had been were bad enough. Then she could not even think without her head splitting. Once she could, what her mother called the itchy hands of idleness had driven her into Telairan Riod behind the wise ones' backs. "You learned nothing resting. The next meeting, you said?" "Perhaps," Milane replied with a shrug. "We will see. But you must eat. If your desire for food is gone, something is wrong that we do not know."
"Oh, I can eat."
The porridge cooking outside did smell good. "I was just being lazy, I suppose." Getting up without wincing was a chore. Her head did not like being moved yet. "I thought of some more questions last night." Milane rolled her eyes in amusement. "Since you were hurt, you ask 5 questions for every one you asked before." Because she was trying to puzzle things out for herself. She could not say that, of course, so she just dug a clean shift from one of the small chests lining the tent wall and exchanged it for her sweaty one.
"Questions are good," Bear said. "Ask."
Egwene chose her words carefully and went on with her dressing casually in the same white Algoda blouse and bulky wool skirt the wise ones wore.
"Is it possible to be pulled into someone's dream against your will?"
"Of course not," Amis said.
"Not unless your touch is all thumbs."
But right on top of her, Bear said,
"Not unless there is strong emotion involved. If you try to watch the dream of someone who loves or hates you, you can be pulled in. Or if you love or hate them. That last is why we do not dare try to watch Savannah's dreams, or even to speak with the Shido wise ones in their dreams."
It still surprised Egwene that these women and the other wise ones all visited and talked with the Shido wise ones. Wise ones were supposed to be above feuds and battles, but she would have thought opposing the Karakarn, vowing to kill him, took the Shido well beyond that.
"Leaving the dream of someone who hates you or loves you," Bear finished, "is like trying to climb from a deep pit with sheer sides."
"There is that." Amis seemed to recover her humor suddenly. She gave Milane a sidelong glance. "That is why no dreamwalker ever makes the mistake of trying to watch her husband's dreams." Milane stared straight ahead, face darkening. She does not make it twice, anyway, Amice added. Bear grinned, deepening the creases of her face, and very pointedly did not look at Milane.
It can be quite a shock, especially if he is angry with you. If, to choose an example from Air, Jito takes him away from you, and you, like some silly child, were foolish enough to tell him he would not go if he loved you.
This is running far afield from her question, a crimson-faced Milane said stiffly. Bear cackled loudly. Egwene stifled curiosity and amusement. She made her voice ever so offhanded. What if you don't try to look in? Milane gave her a grateful look, and she felt a twinge of guilt. Not enough that she would not ask for the whole story later, though. Anything that made Milane blush so had to be hilarious.
I heard of such a thing, Bear said, when I was young and just beginning to learn. Mora, the wise one of Colrada Hold, trained me, and she said that if the emotion was very strong, love or hate so great it left room for nothing else, you could be drawn in merely by letting yourself be aware of the other's dream.
I have never heard anything like that, Milane said. Amice merely looked doubtful.
Nor have I from any save Mora, Bear told them. But she was a remarkable woman. It was said she was approaching her 300th year when she died from a blood snake's bite, yet she looked as young as either of you. I was only a girl, but I remember her well. She knew many things and could channel strongly. Other wise ones came from every clan to learn from her. I think love so great, or hate so, is very rare, but she said this happened to her twice, once with the first man she married, and once with a rival for her third husband's interest.
300? Egwene exclaimed, a soft knee-high boot half-laced. Surely even Aes Sedai did not live that long.
I said that it was, Bear replied, smiling. Some women age more slowly than others, like Amice here, and when it is a woman like Mora, tales are born. Some day I will tell you the story of how Mora moved a mountain, supposedly at least.
Another day, Milane said a touch too politely. Plainly she still smarted over whatever had happened in Bale's dream, and over the fact the others knew.
I heard every tale of Mora when I was a child. I have them all by heart, I think. If Egwene ever finishes dressing, we must see her fed.
A gleam in her green eyes said she meant to watch every bite go down. Clearly her suspicions about Egwene's health had not been soothed. And answer the rest of her questions. Frantically, Egwene fumbled for another. Usually she had a slew of questions, but the events of the night had left her with just that one. If she let it remain at that, they might start wondering whether it had come because she had sneaked off to spy on someone's dream. Another question. Not about her own odd dreams. Some of them probably had meaning if she could ferret it out. Anaya claimed Egwene was a dreamer, able to foretell the course of future events, and these three women thought it might be so, but they said she had to learn it from within. Besides, she was not sure she wanted to discuss her dreams with anyone. These women already knew more than she really liked about what went on inside her head.
What about dreamwalkers who aren't wise ones? I mean, do you ever see other women in Tel Aran Riod?
Sometimes, Amice said, but not often. Without a guide to teach her, a woman may not realize she does more than have vivid dreams.
And, of course, Bear added, unknowing as she is, the dream may well kill her before she can learn.
Safely away from the dangerous topic, Egwene relaxed. She had received more answer than she could have hoped for. She already knew she loved Gawain. Did you, then? A voice whispered. Were you willing to admit it? And his dreams certainly indicated he loved her. Though, of course, if men could say things waking they did not mean, they very probably could dream them. But to have the wise ones confirm it, that he loved her strongly enough to overwhelm anything she... No, that was to be dealt with later. She did not even have an idea where in the world he was. The important thing now was that she knew the danger. She would be able to recognize Gawain's dreams the next time and avoid them.
If you really want to, that small voice whispered.
She hoped the wise ones took the color rising in her cheeks for a healthy glow. She wished she knew what her own dreams meant, if they meant anything.
Yawning, Elaine climbed onto a stone stoop so she could see over the heads of the crowd. There were no soldiers in Salidar today, but people packed the street and hung out of windows, waiting in hushed anticipation, all staring at the little tower. The shuffling of feet and an occasional cough from the rising dust were the only sounds. Despite the early morning heat, people barely moved beyond stirring a fan or hat to make a little breeze. Liana stood in the gap between two thatch-roofed houses, on the arm of a tall, hard-faced man Elaine had never seen before. Very much on his arm. No doubt one of Liana's agents. Most Aes Sedai eyes and ears were women, but Liana's all seemed to be men. She kept them largely out of sight, but Elaine had noticed her once or twice patting an unfamiliar cheek, smiling up at a pair of strange eyes. She had no idea how Liana did it. Elaine was sure if she tried those Damani tricks, the fellow would think she had promised a good deal more than she intended. But these men took a pat and a smile from Liana and went trotting away as happy as if handed a chest of gold. Elsewhere in the crowd, Elaine spotted Birgitta, wisely keeping away from her this morning. For a change, that horrid arena was nowhere to be seen. The night had been well beyond hectic, and Elaine had not gone to bed until the sky was already beginning to lighten toward grey. In truth, she would not have gone at all if Birgitta had not told Ashmanela she thought Elaine looked unsteady. Not a matter of how she looked at all, of course. The bond with a warder ran both ways. So what if she had been a little tired? There had been plenty of work to do, and she could still channel more strongly than half the Aes Sedai in Salidar. That bond told her that Birgitta had not slept yet, not her. Elaine sent off to bed like a novice, while Birgitta carried the injured and cleared away wreckage all night. A glance showed Liana alone now, squeezing into the crowd to find a good place to watch. There was no sign of the tall man. A yawning, bleary-eyed Nynaeve climbed up beside Elaine, glaring down a leather-vested woodcutter who would have gotten there before her. Muttering to himself, the fellow shoved back into the crowd. Elaine wished Nynaeve would not do that. The yawn, not the glare. Her own jaw cracked in mimicry before she could stop it. There was some excuse for Birgitta. Some, maybe. A little, but none for Nynaeve. Theodrin could not possibly expect her to have stayed awake after last night, and Elaine had heard Anaya tell her to go to bed, yet there she was when Elaine came in, balancing herself on the stool despite its now crooked leg, head nodding every 2 minutes, muttering about showing Theodrin, showing everyone. The Eidam bracelet conveyed fear to Elaine, of course, but something that might have been amusement as well. Mogedion had spent the night hiding under her bed, untouched, and because she was well hidden, without picking up one single stick of rubbish. She'd even gotten a good night's sleep once the first commotion died down. It seemed that old saw about the Dark One's luck held sometimes. Nynaeve began another yawn, and Elaine jerked her eyes away. Even so, she had to shove her fist against her mouth in a not very successful attempt to avoid imitation. The shuffling feet and coughs took on an impatient sound. The sitters were still inside the little tower with Tarna, but the Red's roan gelding already stood in the street before the former inn, and a dozen warders were holding their horses' bridles, their color-shifting cloaks making them uneasy to look at, an escort of honor for the first miles of Tarna's journey back to Tar Valon. The crowd waited for more than the tower envoy's departure, though most looked as worn out as Elaine felt.
"You'd think she was...
Nynaeve gaped hard behind her hand.
"Oh, blood and ashes,"
Elaine muttered, or tried to. Everything after O came out a strangled croak around the fist stuffed in her mouth. Linny said remarks like that were the sign of a slow mind and a dull wit, right before washing your mouth out. But sometimes nothing else could sum up your feelings in as few words. She would have said more, but had no chance.
"Why don't they give her a procession?" Nynaeve growled. "I do not see why they have to give the woman all this to do."
And she yawned again. Again.
"Because she is Aes Sedai, sleepyhead," Swan said, joining them.
too, sleepyheads, she added with a glance at Elaine. You'll catch minnows if you keep doing that.
Elaine snapped her mouth shut and gave the woman her coldest stare. As usual, it slid off like rain from a glazed roof tile.
Tarna is Aes Sedai, my girls, Swan went on, peering toward the waiting horses.
Or maybe it was the clean cart that had been pulled in front of the stone building that had her eye.
An Aes Sedai is Aes Sedai, and nothing changes that.
Nynaeve gave her a look she did not see. Elaine was glad Nynaeve held her tongue. The obvious reply would have been hurtful.
What was the toll last night?
Swan answered without looking away from where Tarna would appear.
7 dead here in the village. Nearly 100 in the soldiers' camps. All those swords and axes and the like lying about, and no one to channel them down. There are sisters out there now, healing.
Lord Gareth?
Elaine asked, a touch anxiously. The man might be cold toward her now, but once he had had a warm smile for a child and a pocket that always held hard candies.
Swan snorted so hard that people turned around to look.
That one, she muttered. A lionfish would break its teeth on the man.
You seem in fine temper this morning, Nynaeve said. Have you finally learned what the tower's message is? Gareth Bryn asked you to marry him? Somebody died and left you...
Elaine tried not to look at Nynaeve. Even the sound of a yawn made her jaws creak.
Swan gave Nynaeve a level look, but for once Nynaeve met it just as flatly, if a bit watery-eyed.
If you've learned something, Elaine broke in before they could stare one another senseless, tell us.
A woman who claims to be Aes Sedai when she isn't, Swan murmured as though voicing an idle thought. Is neck deep in a boiling kettle, true enough. But if she's claimed a particular Aja, that Aja has first call on her. Has Mirella ever told you about the woman she caught claiming to be a green in Chachin? A former novice who failed her test for accepted. Ask her sometime when she has an hour or two. It will take that long to tell. The fool girl probably wished she'd been stilled before Mirella was done. Stilled and her head cut off as well.
For some reason the threat had no more effect than the glare had on Nynaeve, not even a quiver. Perhaps they were both just too tired.
You tell me what you know, Elaine said in a low voice, or the next time we're alone I will teach you to sit up straight, and you can run whining to Shiriam if you want.
Swan's eyes narrowed, and suddenly Elaine yelped, clapping a hand to her hip.
Swan drew back the hand that had delivered the pinch without any tried stealth.
I don't take well to threats, girl. You know as well as I do what Elida said. You saw it before anyone here.
Come back?
All is forgiven? Nynaeve said incredulously. More or less. With a load of fish guts about the tower needing to be whole more now than ever, and a bit of slippery eeling about no one needing to fear except those who have placed themselves in true rebellion. The light knows what that means. I don't.
Why are they keeping it secret? Elaine demanded. They can't possibly think anyone will go back to Elida. All they need do is trot out Loghain.
Swan said nothing, only frowned at the waiting warders.
I still don't see why they're asking for more time, Nynaeve muttered.
They know what they have to do.
Swan kept silent, but Nynaeve's eyebrows rose slowly.
You don't know their answer.
I do now, Swan clipped the words and said something under her breath about weak-kneed fools.
Elaine agreed silently.
Suddenly the front door of the one-time inn opened. Half a dozen sitters came out in their fringed shawls, one from each Aja, then Tarna, followed by the rest. If the waiting folk had expected some sort of ceremony, they were sorely disappointed. Climbing into her saddle, Tarna ran her eyes slowly over the sitters, glanced at the crowd with an unreadable face, then heeled the gelding to a walk. Her encircling escort of warders moved with her. A concerned buzz, like the sound of disturbed bees, rose from the onlookers as they gave way. The murmuring lasted until Tarna passed from sight, out of the village, and Romanda climbed up onto the cart, smoothly hitching her yellow-fringed shawl into place. Dead silence fell. By tradition, the eldest sitter made pronouncements from the hall. Romanda did not move like an old woman, of course, and her face was as ageless as any, yet even streaks of gray hair marked considerable age on an Aes Sedai, and the bun gathered at the nape of her neck was pale gray without a trace of anything darker. Elaine wondered how old she was, but asking an Aes Sedai's age was about the rudest thing possible. Romanda wove simple flows of air to make her high soprano voice carry. It came to Elaine as if she had been face to face with the woman. "Many of you have been worried these last few days, but needlessly. Had Tarna Sedai not come to us, we would have sent missives to the White Tower ourselves. After all, we can hardly be said to be hiding here." She paused, as if to give the crowd time to laugh, but they merely stared at her, and she adjusted her shawl. "Our purpose here has not changed. We seek truth and justice to do what is right."
"Right for who?" Nynaeve murmured.
"And we shall neither flag nor fail. Go about your tasks as you have, assured that you remain sheltered beneath our hands, now and after our assured return to our proper places in the White Tower. The light shine upon you all. The light shine upon all of us."
The murmuring rose again, and the crowd began milling slowly as Romanda climbed down. Swan's face might have been carved from stone. Her lips were pinched bloodless. Elaine wanted to ask questions, but Nynaeve hopped off the stoop and began pushing toward the three-story stone building. Elaine followed quickly. Last night, Nynaeve had been ready to toss out what they had learned with never a care. It had to be presented carefully, if it was to be any use in swaying the hall. And it certainly seemed they did need swaying. Romanda's announcement had been a wagon-load of nothing. It had certainly upset Swan. Wriggling between two hefty fellows who were glaring at Nynaeve's back, she had stepped on toes to get by. Elaine glanced over her shoulder and caught Swan watching her and Nynaeve. For just a moment, as soon as the woman realized she had been seen, she pretended to spot someone in the crowd and jumped down as if going to them. Frowning, Elaine hurried on. Was Swan upset, or was she not? How much of her irritation and ignorance were really pretense? Nynaeve's notion of running off to Camelin, Elaine was not sure she had given it up yet, was worse than silly, but she herself was looking forward to Ebu Dar, to doing something of real use. All these secrets and suspicions were an itch she could not reach. If only Nynaeve did not put her foot in it. She caught up to Nynaeve just as the other woman caught Shiriam near the cart Romanda had spoken from. Morvryn was there, too, and Carlinia, all three in their shawls. All the Aes Sedai wore shawls this morning. Carlinia's short hair, worked into a cap of dark curls, was the only sign of their near disaster in Tel Aaron Riud. "We need to speak to you alone," Nynaeve told Shiriam, "in private." Elaine sighed. "Not the best beginning, but not the worst either." Shiriam studied the two of them for a moment, then glanced at Morvryn and Carlinia and said, "Very well. Inside." When they turned, Romanda was between them and the door, a solidly handsome, dark-eyed woman with her yellow-fringed shawl, all flowers and vines except for the flame of Tar Valon, high between her shoulders. Ignoring Nynaeve, she smiled warmly at Elaine, one of those smiles Elaine had come to expect and dread from Aes Sedai. For Shiriam and Carlinia and Morvryn, though, her face was very different. She stared at them, expressionless, head erect, until they dipped slight curtsies and murmured, "By your leave, sitter." Only then did she move aside, and even then she sniffed loudly. The common run of folk never noticed, of course, but Elaine had caught snippets among the Aes Sedai about Shiriam and her little council. Some thought they only saw to the day-to-day running of Salidar, freeing the hall for more important matters. Some knew they had influence with the hall, but how much varied according to who spoke. Romanda was one who believed they had entirely too much. Worse, they had two blues and no yellow in their number. Elaine felt her eyes as she followed the others through the doorway. Shiryam led them to one of the private chambers just off the former common room, with beetle-chewed paneling and a paper-strewn table against one wall. Her eyebrows lifted when Nynaeve asked them to ward against eavesdropping, but she wove the ward around the inside of the room without comment. Remembering Nynaeve's excursion, Elaine checked to be sure both windows were tightly shut.
"I expect no less than news Randall Thor is on his way here," Morvryn said dryly.
A quick glance passed between the other two Aes Sedai. Elaine stifled indignation. They really did think she and Nynaeve were holding back secrets about Rand. Them and their secrets.
"Not that," Nynaeve said, "but something as important in a different way."
And out tumbled the story of their trip to Ebu Dar and finding the bold Turangrial. Not in proper order, and not mentioning the tower, but all the essential points were there.
"Are you certain this bowl is a Turangrial?" Shiryam asked when Nynaeve ran down. "It can affect the weather?"
"Yes, Aes Sedai," Elaine answered simply. Simple was best, to begin. Morvryn grunted. The woman doubted everything.
Shiryam nodded, shifting her shawl. "Then you have done well. We will send a letter to Merlilla." Merlilla Sian Devon was the Grey Sister sent to convince the Queen in Ebu Dar to support Salidar. "We will need all the details from you."
"She'll never find it," Nynaeve burst out before Elaine could open her mouth. "Elaine and I can."
Aes Sedai eyes chilled.
"It probably would be impossible for her," Elaine put in hastily. "We saw where the bowl is, and it will be difficult for us, but at least we know what we saw. Describing it in a letter just won't be the same."
"Ebu Dar is no place for accepted," Carlinia said coldly.
Morvryn's tone was a little more kindly, if still gruff.
"We must all do what we can do best, child. Do you think Edesina or Afara or Gwaisin wanted to go to Tarabon? What can they do to bring order to that unquiet land? But we must try, so they went. Kiruna and Bera are probably in the spine of the world right this minute, on their way to search for Randall Thor in the Aiel Waste, because we thought, only thought, when we sent them that he might be there. That we were right makes their journey no less futile now with him out of the waste. We all do what we can, what we must. You two are accepted. Accepted do not go running off to Ebu Dar or anywhere else. What you two can and must do is remain here and study. Were you full sisters, I would still say keep you here. No one has made the sort of discoveries you have, the sheer number in so short a time in 100 years.
Nynaeve being Nynaeve, she ignored what she did not want to hear and focused on Carlinia.
"We've done very well on our own, thank you. I doubt Ebu Dar can be as bad as Tanchico."
Elaine did not think the woman knew she had a death grip on her braid. Would Nynaeve never learn that simple civility sometimes won what honesty would surely lose?
"I understand your concerns, Aes Sedai," Elaine said. "But however immodest it might be, the truth is that I am better qualified to locate a Turangrial than anyone else in Salidar. And Nynaeve and I know better where to look than we could ever put on paper. If you send us to Merlilla Sedai, under her guidance I am sure we could locate it in short order. A few days to Ebu Dar by riverboat and a few days back, with a few days under Merlilla Sedai's eye in Ebu Dar."
It was an effort not to draw a deep breath.
"In the meantime, you could send a message to one of Swan's eyes and ears in Camelin, so it will be there when Mirana Sedai and the embassy arrive."
"Why under the light should we do that?" Morvryn rumbled.
"I thought Nynaeve told you, Aes Sedai. I'm not sure, but I think the bowl needs a man channeling, too, to make it work."
That caused a small commotion, of course.
Carlinia gasped, and Morvryn muttered to herself, and Shiryam's mouth actually fell open. Nynaeve gaped as well, but just for an instant. Elaine was sure she covered before the others noticed. They were too stunned to see very much. The thing was, it was a lie, pure and simple. Simple was the key. Supposedly the greatest achievements in the Age of Legends had been done by men and women channeling together, probably linked. Very likely there were Turangrial that needed a man to work. In any case, if she could not work the bowl alone, certainly no one in Salidar could, except Nynaeve, maybe.
If it required Rand, they could not pass up the chance to do something about the weather, and by the time she discovered that a circle of women could manage the bowl, the Aes Sedai and Salidar would have tied themselves to Rand too tightly to break loose.
"That is all very well," Shiriam said at last, "but it does not change the fact that you are accepted. We will send a letter to Merlilla. There has been some talk about the two of you."
"Talk," Nynaeve snapped. "That is all you do. You and the Hall. Talk. Elaine and I can find this Turangrial, but you would rather prattle like laying hens."
Words tumbled over each other, coming out of her. She kept such a steady strain on her braid, Elaine half expected to see it come loose in her hand.
"You sit here hoping Tom and Julin and the others will come back and tell you the White Cloaks aren't going to fall on us like a house, when they might come back with White Cloaks on their heels. You sit poking at the problem of Elaida instead of doing what you said you would, fumbling over Rand. Do you know how you stand toward him yet? Do you, with your embassy on its way to Camelin? Do you know why you sit and talk? I do. You're afraid. Afraid of the Tower Divided. Afraid of Rand, the Forsaken, the Black Aja. Last night, Anaya let slip that you had a plan ready in case one of the Forsaken attacked. All those circles linking right on top of the bubble of evil. Do you finally believe in that? But all mismatched, and most with more novices than Aes Sedai. Because only a few Aes Sedai knew beforehand. You think the Black Aja's right here in Salidar. You were afraid your plan might get back to Samael or one of the others. You don't trust each other. You don't trust anybody. Is that why you won't send us to Ebudar? Do you think we're Black Aja? Or we'll run off to Rand? Or...
She trailed off in furious splutters and panting. She had hardly drawn breath through the entire tirade. Elaine's first wincing instinct was to smooth it over somehow, though how was a question she could not begin to answer. As easy to smooth over a mountain range. It was the Aes Sedai who made her forget to worry whether Nynaeve had managed to shatter everything. Those expressionless faces, those eyes that seemed able to see through stone, should have conveyed nothing at all. To her they did convey something. There was none of the cold anger that should have flowed toward anyone foolish enough to rant at Aes Sedai. This was a covering up, and the only thing to hide was truth, a truth they did not want to admit themselves. They were afraid.
"Are you quite done?" Carlinia asked, in a voice that should have frozen the sun in its flight. Elaine sneezed, banging her head on the side of the overturned cauldron. The smell of burned soup filled her nose. The mid-morning sun had heated the dark interior of the big cook-pot until it felt as if it still sat on a fire. Sweat dripped off her. No, it poured off her. Dropping the coarse pumice stone, she backed out on her knees and glared at the woman next to her, or rather at the half of a woman sticking out of a slightly smaller kettle lying on its side. She poked Nynaeve in the hip and smiled grimly when the poke produced the bang of a head against iron and a yelp. Nynaeve backed out with a baleful stare, not hindered at all by a yawn she stifled behind a grimy hand. Elaine gave her no chance to speak.
"You just had to blow up, didn't you? You couldn't hold on to your temper for 5 minutes. We had everything in our hands and you had to kick us in the ankles."
"They wouldn't have let us go to Ebudar anyway," Nynaeve muttered. "And I didn't do all the kicking of ankles."
She shoved her chin up in a ridiculous fashion so she had to look down her nose to see Elaine.
"Aes Sedai rule their fear," she said in tones that might have done for berating a drunken layabout who had staggered into your horse. "They do not allow it to rule them. Lead, and we will follow gladly, but you must lead, not cower, hoping that something will make your troubles vanish."
Elaine's cheeks heated. She had not looked anything like that, and she certainly had not sounded like that.
"Well, perhaps we both overstepped good sense, but—"
She cut off at the sound of a footstep.
"So the Aes Sedai's golden children have decided to take a rest, have they?"
Faolaine's smile was as far from friendly as it was possible for a smile to be.
"I am not here for the joy of it, you know. I meant to spend today working on something of my own, something not terribly inferior to what you golden children have done, I think. Instead, I must watch accepted scrub pots for their sins. Watch, so you don't sneak off like the wretched novices the pair of you should be. Now back to work. I can't leave until you're done, and I do not intend to spend the whole day here."
The dark, curly-haired woman was like Theodrin, something more than accepted, but less than Aes Sedai. As Elaine and Nynaeve would have been, if Nynaeve had not behaved like a stepped-on cat. Nynaeve and herself, Elaine amended reluctantly. Shiriam had told them as much in the middle of telling them just how long they would be working their free hours in the kitchens, the dirtiest work the cooks could find. But no Ebudar in any case. That had been made clear, too. A letter would be on its way to Merlilla by noon, if not already.
"I am sorry," Nynaeve said, and Elaine blinked at her.
Apologies from Nynaeve were snow in midsummer.
"I'm sorry, too, Nynaeve."
"Yes, you are," Faelaine told them. "As sorry as I have seen. Now back to work, before I find reason to send you to Tiana when you're done here."
With a rueful glance at Nynaeve, Elaine crawled back into the cauldron, attacking the charred soap with the pumice stone as though attacking Faelaine. Stone dust and bits of black-burned vegetable flew. No, not Faelaine. The Aes Sedai, sitting when they should be acting. She was going to get to Ebudar. She was going to find that Turangrial, and she was going to use it to tie Shiriam and all the rest of them to Rand. On their knees! Her sneeze very nearly took her shoes off. Shiriam turned from where she had been watching the young women through a crack in the fence and began walking up the narrow alley with its fitful crop of withered weeds and stubble.
"I regret that."
Considering Nynaeve's words, and her tone, and Elaine's, the wretched child, she added, "somewhat." Carlinia sneered. She was very good at that.
"Do you want to tell Accepted what fewer than 24 Aes Sedai know?"
Her mouth clicked shut at a sharp look from Shiriam.
"There are ears where we least expect them," Shiriam said softly.
"Those girls are right about one thing," Morvryn said. "Al Thor turns my bowels to water. What options are left to us with him?"
Shiriam was not sure they had not long since run out of options.
Chapter 16. Tellings of the Wheel. With the dragon scepter across his knees, Rand lounged on the dragon throne. Or made a show of lounging, at least. Thrones were not made for relaxation. This one least of all, it seemed. But that was only part of the difficulty. Sensing Alana was part two, for all that it nudged at him constantly. If he told the maidens, they would... No. How could he even think of that? He had frightened her enough to keep her at bay. She had made no effort to enter the inner city. He would know if she did. Now, for the moment, Alana was less of a problem than the inadequate seat cushion. Despite the silver-worked blue coat buttoned to its collar, the heat did not reach him. He really was getting the way of Taim's trick. But if pure impatience had produced sweat, he would have dripped as if just climbing out of a river. Keeping cool presented no problem at all. Keeping still did. He intended to give Elaine an Andor whole and unharmed. And this morning would be the first real step to that. If they ever came.
"And in addition,"
the tall, bony man standing before the throne said in a near monotone, 1,423
refugees from Murundi, 567 from Altara, and 109 from Ilion. As far as the headcount inside the city proper has gone to this date, I hasten to add."
The few wisps of gray hair remaining to Holwyn Nori stood up like quill pens stuck behind his ears, appropriate since he had been Morghese's chief clerk.
"I have hired 23 additional clerks for the enumeration, but the number is still clearly insufficient for..."
Rand stopped listening. Grateful as he was that the man had not run away, as so many others had, he was not certain anything was real to Nori, except the numbers in his ledgers. He recited the number of deaths during the week and the price of turnips carted in from the countryside in the same dusty tone, arranged the daily burials of penniless, friendless refugees with no more horror and no more joy. Then he showed hiring masons to check the repair of the city walls. Ilion was just another land to him, not the abode of Samael, and Rand just another ruler. "Where are they?" he wondered furiously. "Why hasn't Alana at least tried to sidle up to me?" Moraine would never have been frightened off so easily.
"Where are all the dead?" Luz Theron whispered. "Why will they not be silent?"
Rand chuckled grimly. Surely that had to be a joke. Sulin was sitting easily on her haunches to one side of the throne's dais, and red-haired Urien to the other. Today, 20 Aethon d'Or, red shields, waited among the Grand Hall's columns with the maidens, some wearing the red headband. They stood or squatted or sat, some talking quietly, but as usual looked ready to spring into action in a heartbeat. Even the maiden and two red shields who were dicing. At least one pair of eyes always seemed to be watching Nori. Few Aiel trusted a wetlander this close to Rand. Abruptly, Bashir appeared in the hall's tall doorway. When he nodded, Rand sat up. At last. At bloody last. The green and white tassel swayed as he gestured with the dragon-carved length of the Seanchan spear. "You've done well, Master Nori. Your report left nothing out. I will see that the gold you need is provided. But I must attend to other matters now, if you will forgive me." The man gave no sign of curiosity or hurt at being cut off so abruptly. He merely stopped in mid-word, bowed with, "As the Lord Dragon commands," in that same dry tone, and backed away three steps before turning. He did not even glance at Bashir in passing. Nothing real but the ledgers. Impatiently, Rand nodded to Bashir and set himself erect and stiff-backed on the throne. The Aiel went silent. It made them seem twice as ready. When the Saldaean entered, he did not come alone. Two men and two women followed close behind, none young, in rich silks and brocades. They tried to pretend Bashir did not exist and almost carried it off, but the watchful Aiel among the columns were another story. Golden-haired Dylan missed only a step, but Abella and Luan, both graying yet hard-faced, frowned at the cadensor-clad figures and instinctively felt for the swords they did not wear today, while Alorian, a plump, dark-haired woman, who would have been pretty were her face not so determinedly stony, stopped dead and glared before she came to herself and caught up to the others with a quick stride. Their first good view of Rand took them aback as well, all of them. Quick, wondering glances passed between them. Perhaps they had thought he would be older.
"My Lord Dragon," Bashir intoned loudly, halting before the dais. "Lord of the Morning, Prince of the Dawn, true defender of the light, before whom the world kneels in awe, I give to you Lady Dylan of House Taravin, Lord Abella of House Pendar, Lady Alorin of House Tremaine, and Lord Pellavar of House Corlan."
The four Enderans looked at Bashir then, with tight lips and sharp sidelong glances. There had been something in his tone that made it sound as if he was giving Rand four horses. To say their spines stiffened would be to say water became wetter, yet it seemed so as they stared up at Rand. Mostly at Rand. Their eyes could not help drifting to the lion throne, shining and glittering on its pedestal beyond his head. He wanted to laugh at their outraged faces. Outraged, but also careful, and perhaps a touch impressed in spite of themselves. He and Bashir had worked out that list of titles between them, but the bit about the world kneeling was new, Bashir's own late addition. Moraine had given him the advice, though. He almost thought he heard her silvery voice again. "How people see you first is what they hold hardest in their minds. It is the way of the world. You can step down from a throne, and even if you behave like a farmer in a pigsty, Some part in each of them will remember that you did descend from a throne. But if they see only a young man first, a countryman, they will resent him stepping up to his throne later, whatever his right, whatever his power.
Well, if a title or two could make anything so, everything would be a deal easier.
I was the Lord of the Morning, Luz Theron mumbled. I am the Prince of the Dawn.
Rand kept his face smooth.
I will not welcome you. This is your land and the palace of your queen, but I am pleased you accept my invitation.
After 5 days, and with just a few hours' notice, but he did not mention that. Rising, he laid the dragon scepter on the throne, then trotted down from the dais, with a reserved smile.
Never be hostile unless you must, Moraine had said, but above all, never be overly friendly, never be eager.
He gestured to 5 comfortably cushioned chairs with padded backs set in a circle among the columns.
Join me. We will talk and have some chilled wine.
They followed, of course, eyeing the Aiel and him with equal curiosity and perhaps equal animosity, both poorly hidden. When they were all seated, Gashain came, silent in their hooded white robes, bringing wine and golden goblets already damp with condensation. Another stood behind each chair with a plumed fan, gently stirring the air. Every chair but Rand's. They noted that, noted the lack of sweat on his face. But the Gashain did not perspire either, even in their robes, and neither did the other Aiel. He watched the nobles' faces over his own wine cup. Andorans were proud of being more straightforward than many, and they were not slow to boast that the game of houses was far more entwined in other lands than in theirs. Yet they still believed they could play Deus Dimar when they had to. After a fashion they could, but the truth was Cariennan and even Tyrans considered them simple when it came to the subtle move and countermove of the great game. These 4 kept their composure for the most part, but to someone schooled by Moraine, schooled harder in Tyr and Cairien, they gave away much with every shift of eye, every slight change of expression. First it dawned on them that there was no chair for Bashir. Quick looks flickered between them, a slight brightening, especially when they realized Bashir was striding from the throne room. All 4 actually let themselves glance after him with the faintest of satisfied smiles. They must dislike a Saldaean army in Andor as much as Naon and that lot did. Now their thoughts were obvious. Perhaps the foreigner's influence was less than they had feared. Why, Bashir had been treated as no more than a superior servant. Dylan's eyes widened slightly, at almost the same instant as Luan's, and only a moment ahead of the other 2. For a moment they stared at Rand so closely it was plain they avoided looking at one another. Bashir was an outlander, but also the Marshal General of Saldaea, 3 times a lord and uncle to Queen Tenobia. If Rand used him like a servant...
"Excellent wine,"
stirring into his goblet, Luan hesitated before adding,
"My Lord Dragon."
It might have been pulled out of him with a rope.
"From the south," Elorian said after a sip, "a Tanaigan Hills vintage. A wonder you can find ice in Camelon this year. I have heard people already calling this the year without a winter."
"Do you think I would waste time and effort finding ice," Rand said, "when so many troubles inflict the world?"
Abella's angular face paled, and he seemed to force himself to take another swallow. On the other hand, Luan emptied his wine cup deliberately and thrust it out to be filled by Gashain, whose green eyes flashed a fury at strong odds with the obstinate mildness of his sun-dark face. Serving wetlanders was like being a servant, and Aiel despised the very notion of servants. How that disgust squared with the very concept of Gashain, Rand had never been able to determine, but it was so. Dylan held her wine firmly on her knees and ignored it thereafter. This close, Rand could see touches of gray in her golden hair. She was still lovely, though in nothing except the hair did she look at all like Morghese or Elaine. Next in line for the throne, she must be a cousin at least, and close. Frowning briefly at him, she seemed on the point of shaking her head, but instead said, "We are concerned with the world's troubles, but more with those inflicting Andor. Did you bring us here to find a cure?" "If you know one," Rand replied simply. "If not, I must look elsewhere. Many think they know the right cure. If I cannot find the one I want, I will have to accept the next best." That tightened mouths. On the way here, Bashir had taken them through a courtyard, where Aramilla and Lur and the rest of those had been left cooling their heels, taking their ease in the palace, it would seem. "I would think you'd want to help put Andor back together. You've heard my proclamation." He did not have to say which one. In this context, there could be only one. "A reward offered for news of Elaine," Elorian said flatly, her face becoming even stonier. "Who is to be made queen now that Morghese is dead?" Dylan nodded. "That seemed well to me."
"Not to me," Elorian snapped. "Morghese betrayed her friends and spurned her oldest adherents. Let us see an end to House Trakand on the Lion Throne."
She seemed to have forgotten Rand. They all did.
"Dylan,"
Luan said curtly. She shook her head, as if she had heard this before, but he went on.
"She has the best claim. I speak for Dylan."
"Elaine is the daughter heir," the golden-haired woman told them levelly. "I speak for Elaine."
"What does it matter who any of us speak for?" Abella demanded. "If he killed Morghese, he will—"
Abella cut off abruptly with a grimace, then looked at Rand, not exactly in defiance, but definitely daring him to do his worst, and expecting him to.
"Do you really believe that?"
Rand glanced sadly at the Lion Throne on its pedestal. "Why, under the light, would I kill Morghese only to hand that to Elaine?"
"If you know what to believe," Elorian said stiffly.
Spots of color stained her cheeks.
"People say many things, most foolish."
"Such as?" He directed the question to her, but it was Dylan who answered, looking him straight in the eye.
"That you will fight the last battle and kill the Dark One. That you are a false dragon, or an Aes Sedai puppet, or both. That you're Morghese's illegitimate son, or a Tyran High Lord, or an Aielman."
She frowned again for a moment, but did not stop.
"That you are the son of an Aes Sedai by the Dark One. That you are the Dark One, or else the Creator, clothed in flesh. That you will destroy the world, save it, subjugate it, bring a new age. As many tales as there are mouths. Most say you killed Morghese, many add Elaine. They say your proclamation is a mask to hide your crimes."
Rand sighed. Some of those sayings were worse than any he had heard. "I won't ask which you believe." Why did she keep frowning at him? She was not the only one. Luan did too, and Abella and Elorian darted the sort of glances at him that he had come to expect from Aramilla's bunch when they thought he was not looking.
"Watching, watching."
That was Luz Theron, a hoarse giggling whisper.
"I see you. Who sees me?"
"Instead, will you help me make Andor whole again? I don't want Andor to become another Kyrian, or worse, a Terrabon or Aradoman."
"I know something of the Koreathon cycle," Abella said. "I believe you are the dragon reborn. But nothing there speaks of you ruling, only fighting the Dark One at Tarmogaden."
Rand's hand tightened on his goblet so hard the dark surface of the wine trembled. How much easier if these four were like most of the Tyran High Lords or the Kyrianin. But not one of them wanted a shaving more power for themselves than they already had. However the wine had been chilled, he doubted the one power would intimidate this lot. In all likelihood, they'd tell me to kill them and be burned for it.
Burn for it,
Luz Theron echoed morosely. How many times must I say I don't want to rule Andor? When Elaine sits on the Lion Throne, I will leave Andor, and never return if I have my way.
If the throne belongs to anyone, Elorian said tightly, it belongs to Dailan. If you mean what you say, see her crowned and go. Then Andor will be whole, and I don't doubt Andoran soldiers will follow you to the last battle if that's what is called for. I refuse still, Dailan answered in a strong voice, then turned to Rand. I will wait and consider, my Lord Dragon. When I see Elaine alive and crowned, and you leave Andor, I will send my retainers to follow you, whether anyone else in Andor does the same. But if time passes and you still reign here, or if your Aiel savages do hear what I've heard they did in Carrion and Tyr...
She scowled at the maidens in red shields, and the Gaishin too, as if she saw them looting and burning.
Or you loose here those men you gather with your amnesty, then I will come against you, whether anyone else in Andor does the same.
And I will ride beside you, Luan said firmly.
And I, Elorian said, echoed by Abella.
Rand threw back his head and laughed in spite of himself, half mirth, half frustration. Light, and I thought honest opposition would be better than sneaking behind my back or licking my boots. They eyed him uneasily, doubtless thinking it was madness at work. Maybe it was. He was not sure himself anymore.
"Consider what you must," he told them,
standing to end the audience.
"I mean what I said. But consider this as well. Tommen Gaiden is coming closer. I don't know how long we have for you to spend considering."
They made their goodbyes, a careful bow of the head, as between equals, and that more than when they arrived. But as they turned to go, Rand caught Dailan's sleeve. "I have a question for you." The others paused, half turning back. "A private question." After a moment she nodded, and her companions moved a little way down the throne room. They watched closely, but they were not near enough to hear.
"You looked at me strangely," he said.
"You and every noble I've met in Caemlyn. Every Andoran noble, at least."
"Why?"
Dailan peered up at him, then finally nodded slightly to herself.
"What is your mother's name?"
Rand blinked.
"My mother?"
Kariel Thor was his mother. That was how he thought of her. She had raised him from infancy until she died. But he decided to give her the cold truth he had learned in the waste.
"My mother's name was Shael. She was a maiden of the spear. My father was Janduin, clan chief of the Tardad Aiel."
Her eyebrows rose doubtfully.
"I will swear it on any oath you choose. What does that have to do with what I want to know? They're both long dead."
Relief crept across her face.
"A chance resemblance, it seems, no more.
I do not mean to say you don't know your parents, but you have the west of Andor on your tongue."
"A resemblance? I grew up in the Two Rivers, but my parents were as I said. Who do I look like to make you stare at me?" She hesitated, then sighed.
"I do not suppose it matters. Some day you must tell me how you had Aiel parents yet were raised in Andor."
25 years ago, more now, the daughter heir of Andor vanished in the night. Her name was Tigraine. She left behind a husband, Tarengail, and a son, Galad. I know it is only chance, yet I see Tigraine in your face. It was a shock."
Rand felt a shock of his own. He felt cold.
fragments of the tale the wise ones had told him, spun through his head. A golden-haired young wetlander in silks, son she loved, a husband she did not. Shail was the name she took. She never gave another. You have something of her in your features. How was it that Tigraine vanished?
I have an interest in the history of Andor.
I will thank you not to call it history, my lord dragon. I was a girl when it happened, but more than a child, and here in the palace often. One morning Tigraine simply was not in the palace, and she was never seen again. Some claimed to see Tarangale's hand in it, but he was half mad with grief. Tarangale Damodred wanted more than anything else in the world to see his daughter, Queen of Andor, and his son, King of Cairhien. He was Cairhienin, Tarangale. That marriage was meant to stop the wars with Cairhien, and it did. Yet Tigraine vanishing made them think Andor wanted to break the treaty, which led them to scheme the way Cairhienin do, which led to Laemon's pride. And you, of course, know where that led, she added dryly. My father said Jitara Sedai was really at fault.
Jitara?
A wonder he did not sound strangled. He had heard that name more than once. It had been an Aes Sedai named Jitara Moroso, a woman with the foretelling who announced that the dragon had been reborn on the slopes of Dragonmount, and so set Moraine and Swan on their long search. It had been Jitara Moroso who, years before that, told Shail that unless she fled to the waste, telling no one, and became a maiden of the spear, disaster would fall on Andor and the world. Dailan nodded, a touch impatiently.
Jitara was counselor to Queen Modralang, she said briskly, but she spent more time with Tigraine and Luke, Tigraine's brother, than with the queen. After Luke rode north, never to return, whispers said Jitara had convinced him that his fame lay in the blight, or his fate. Others said it was that he would find the dragon reborn there, or that the last battle depended on him going. That was about a year before Tigraine disappeared. Myself, I doubt Jitara had anything to do with it, or with Luke. She stayed the queen's counselor until Modraline died, from heartbreak over Tigraine on top of Luke, so it was said. Which began the succession, of course. She glanced toward the others, who were shifting their feet and frowning with suspicion and impatience, but she could not resist adding one more thing. You would have found a different Andor without that. Tigraine, queen, Morgay's only high seat of House Trakand. Elaine not born at all. Morgay's married Tarangale once she had the throne, you see. Who can say what else would be changed?
Watching her join the others and go, he thought of one thing that would have changed. He would not be in Andor, for he would not have been born. Everything folded back into itself in endless circles. Tigraine went to the waste in secret, which made Laemon Damodred cut down Aven Doraldera, a gift of the Aiel, to make a throne, an act which brought the Aiel across the spine of the world to kill him. That had been their only goal, though the nations called it the Aiel War. And with the Aiel came a maiden named Shail, who died giving birth. So many lives changed, lives ended, so she could give birth to him at the proper time and place and die doing it. Kariel Thor was the mother he remembered, if dimly, yet he wished he could have known Tigraine or Shail, or whatever she wanted to call herself, even if only for a little while, just to have seen her. Useless dreaming, she was long dead. It was over and done. So why did it still nag at him? The wheel of time and the wheel of a man's life turn alike without pity or mercy, Luz Theron murmured. Are you really there? Rand thought. If there's more than a voice and a few old memories, answer me.
Are you there?
Silence. He could use Moraine's advice now, or somebody's. Abruptly he realized he was staring at the white marble wall of the Grand Hall, staring just north of west, toward Alana. She was away from Culain's hound.
No! Burn her!
He would not replace Moraine with a woman who would ambush him that way. He could not trust any woman touched by the tower, except three. Elaine, Nynaeve, and Egwene. He hoped he could trust them, if only just a little. For some reason he looked up at the great vaulted ceiling with its colored windows depicting battles and queens, alternating with the white lion. Those more than life-size women seemed to stare at him in disapproval, wondering what he was doing there,